Senate Bill 704A. Kat, could you please give us an overview of the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 704A, as drafted, requires dentists to practice in Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, Lane, Lynn, and Polk counties to have an amalgam separator installed in a wastewater drain if materials containing mercury pass through the drain. It exempts until July 1st, 2013, dentists who follow best management practices outlined by the Oregon Dental Association. The bill imposes civil penalties and authorizes the Oregon Board of Dentistry to increase dental licensing fees to cover costs under the bill. It sets an operative date of July 1st, 2008.
Okay. Thank you. And we have several people want to testify. And what I will be doing is I will call up folks three at a time so we can move through quickly on each of the bills because we have quite a bit of folks who want to testify on each one. And first, I will call up Mary Newell, Cheyenne Chapman, and Sandra Duffy. Oh, okay. You know what? We actually have somebody who's going to provide an overview. So, Cheyenne, if you can just sit right on the sort of deck there, I'll bring up Michael Mason, who is going to do a quick introduction. That's fine. And then we'll jump into these three ladies.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the House Energy and Environment Committee. Michael Mason with the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. This Senate Bill 704 came about out of a concern expressed by many tribes throughout the Northwest based on fish consumption levels and in recent studies that have indicated that mercury is present in fish throughout the West. The Oregon State University study that came out at the beginning of the year was pretty startling about that. And one of the sources of methyl mercury in the environment that then gets into the fish, that then gets into our bodies, is the dental mercury, you know, coming from a lot of it coming from replacement fillings. The folks here at the table have a lot more information on the science on this or how this works, but out of that concern, we worked with the chairs, yourself, Chair Dingfelder, and Chair Avakian, on trying to put forward a bill that would sharply curtail the amount of mercury going into the sewage treatment plants and thus into the waterways of Oregon from dental offices. So that's basically the point of the bill. We can talk later about kind of conceptual amendments and how it might be streamlined a bit. But it is still intended to be a statewide bill, even though the 704A limits it down to the counties that have the most impact on the Columbia Willamette system, which is, of course, where the fish we're eating and the fish Indian people are eating are primarily traversing. So,
all right, thank you. And if I understand right, there are some amendments, but those are not ready yet for with the committee?
Chair, that's correct. Unfortunately, they aren't quite ready.
All right, thank you. And you'll stick around if there's questions that come up.
Yes, Chair, I'll be here.
Okay.
Hi.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I am Mary Ann Newell, and I'll be reading a letter from an Oregon mercury-free dentist, Dr. Jeffrey Williamson. I am a mercury-free dentist and practice in Lake Oswego. I am sending this letter to you to urge the passage which will require all dentists in Oregon to install an amalgam separator on their wastewater lines. Objections to separators based on cost are misplaced. I purchased and installed a separator about 5 years ago. It cost me $1,200. Annual maintenance is approximately $300. This represents a very, very small expense in comparison to the rest of my dental practice equipment. As a mercury-free dentist, I recognize the toxicity of mercury in amalgam and take extraordinary precautions to prevent mercury exposure to my patients, my office staff, and myself. There is no reason that all dentists in the state cannot install separators in a 6 to 12 month period. It makes no sense to limit the applicability to applying the bill, Senate Bill 704, to only six counties. The citizens of every county in Oregon deserve to be protected from the adverse health harm linked to mercury exposure. The amendment limiting the bill to six counties should be deleted from the bill. The amendment to SB 704, which creates 5 years exemption for dentists who use best management practices as determined by Oregon Dental Association, should also be deleted. In essence, this puts into place the status quo for six more years. There is no way to determine if best practices are being used and no enforcement mechanism if they are not. The governor has designated cleanup of the biocumulative persistent toxins, especially mercury from the Willamette River, as a governor's priority. Another 6 years of allowing mercury amalgam as a source of mercury contamination in the waterways undermines the governor's goal and is unacceptable. Jeffrey Williamson.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have a copy that you would like to provide?
Yes, we have provided that for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Cheyenne Chapman. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Center for Environmental Health. We're an organization, a 501c3 organization, working to protect the public health and the environment from toxic chemicals, including mercury. And on behalf of the center, I want to urge you to act today to protect Oregonians from the harmful effects of mercury used in dentistry by voting for SB 704 as introduced in the Senate and rejecting the amendments in the A engrossed version. And I would add that we would certainly be happy to be a resource in reviewing other amendments that might be in process as well. The center is working on the fish consumption rate study referred to by the previous speaker. It's certainly another important issue in way of looking at mercury in the environment. According to DEQ's reports, the three leading sources of mercury in Oregon's solid waste stream are fluorescent lamps, thermostats, and dental amalgam from dental facilities. While recent legislation mandates the elimination of mercury thermometers and thermostats, mercury from fluorescent lamps and dental amalgam remains unregulated to any serious degree. Mercury amalgam is extensively used by dentists, with weight for sometimes as much as 45% to 55%. The significant and widespread use of mercury by the dental industry remains largely unregulated. There are no federal regulations or industry-wide standard procedures for waste disposal in private dental clinics. Dentists often put amalgam waste into the biomedical waste container, the garbage, or simply down the drain. In Oregon, a 2002 statewide dental survey conducted by the Oregon Dental Association found that more than half of the state dentists are not using any form of recovery system for mercury. It's flushed right down the drain. And I'd like to highlight why we are opposed to the amendments in the A engrossed version. We believe that the amendments greatly diminish the original intent of protecting public health and the environment. The amendment allows dentists using the best management practices to be exempt until 2013, as was mentioned by a previous speaker. Currently, all dentists in Oregon self-report on their implementation of best management practices. These dentists are issued certificates for 2 years stating these dentists are environmentally green without any data collection or verification on these statements. While dentists following these BMPs are to be commended, the reality is that many dentists often put amalgam wastes into the biomedical waste container, the garbage, or simply down the drain. 1 in 10 reproductive-aged women in America carry enough mercury in their blood to pose a threat of neurological damage to the fetus if they got pregnant, according to a 2001 Center for Disease Control and Prevention study. Relying on self-reported BMPs to address mercury without some check on their effectiveness is not a proactive or protective solution to address this bioaccumulative toxic. On behalf of the center, I urge you to reject the amendment exempting dentists and their best management practices. We should not have to wait until 2013, especially when a viable separator technology is available now. Ultimately, your positive action on this measure will contribute to a healthier community and the environment. Thank you.
My name is Sandra Duffy. By day, I am a land use lawyer from Multnomah County. Every other waking hour, I am an advocate for the health and environment. I am board president for Consumers for Dental Choice, a national nonprofit headquartered in Washington, D.C. Our mission is to abolish the use of mercury in dental fillings to protect the environment and the health of America. I am here today to urge you to vote for Senate Bill 704, deleting the two amendments that were adopted by the Senate as an important first step to keeping mercury out of the Oregon environment. Amalgam is a metallic alloy consisting primarily of four metals, mercury, silver, copper, and tin, with mercury comprising more than 50% of the amalgam materials by weight. By far, dental clinics are collectively the single largest wastewater polluters and the third largest users of mercury in the U.S. Mercury from dental fillings is the primary source of mercury in waste treatment plants. The mandate for amalgam separators has resulted in astonishing declines in the amount of mercury in wastewater treatment plants in other jurisdictions. Ontario, Canada had a 71% decline in mercury content. King County had a decline of 40 to 60% in its various treatment plants. And the city county of San Francisco had a 90% decline. They also attribute the other 10% to the mercury that's in the feces and urine that also comes into the waste treatment plant. So they're actually asserting that 100% of the mercury in their waste treatment plants has come from dental amalgams. I have provided a copy of my testimony for you, and it includes a chart from the U.S. EPA, which estimates that 14% of all mercury used in the U.S. today is for dental fillings. Current dental practices result in significant quantities of mercury being flushed down the drain, released into landfills, incinerators, waterways, and contributing to the buildup of this toxic heavy metal in the environment. A huge problem that no one is talking about is that there are over 1,000 tons of mercury stored in the teeth of Americans in this country. This is over 50% of the mercury now existing in mercury-added products in use in this country. Every bit of that will eventually end up in the environment. Oregon's share of that, based on population, is 11 tons, or 22,000 pounds of mercury in the heads of Oregonians. One of the Senate amendments limits the applicability of the requirement for amalgam separators to six counties.
I'm sorry, I just said half that's in my mouth.
Oh, I'm sorry. I do have a list of mercury-free dentists.
Yep, that's the Mad Hatter.
Okay. All of Oregon citizens are entitled to protection from this mercury exposure, not just the six counties named in the amendment. And the other Senate amendment allows all dentists to claim to follow best management practices as determined by the Oregon Dental Association to avoid installing amalgam separators until July 2013. More than 6 years from now. An amalgam filling has a 10 to 15 year life. Thus, approximately one half of that 22,000 pounds of mercury filling stored in the heads of Oregonians is going to be drilled out in the next 6 years. And most of it will end up in the wastewater from the water vacuum used while the mercury fillings are being drilled out. Approximately 70 million amalgam dental fillings are placed every year. Of those, 70% are replacement fillings as opposed to new fillings. Unless proper management systems are put in place, amalgam use reduced, and pollution from this source is going to continue. I don't have time to go into all the adverse effects on the environment and human body from the mercury exposure, but you need to take real action to reduce exposures to mercury in order to reverse the increasing levels of mercury in our environment. In conclusion, mercury pollution comprises the most basic human rights to life, clean food, water, to work in safe environments, environmental health, and the rights of indigenous people to preserve traditional ways of life and foodways. Senate Bill 704, without the Senate amendments, is an important intermediate step which can be taken to stop the cycle of poison that mercury use and pollution perpetuates. It will capture large quantities of dental mercury from entering the environment, but banning the use of mercury dental fillings is the only real long-term solution. In addition to providing you with copies of my own testimony, I've provided you with copies of the Senate Bill 704 amendments that I'm asking that you delete. Dr. Williamson's letter has been provided to you, a resolution from the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians, which is supporting this bill as it was originally drafted. A letter from Charles Brand, who's the National Council for Consumers for Dental Choice in Washington, D.C. A scientific study abstract showing that goldfish exposed to amalgam uptake the mercury. The American Dental Association often says that it's not bioavailable, and this completely disintegrates that argument. And I thank you for your attention today. Thank you.
Thank you. Do any of you happen to know how many other states have similar legislation in place?
I know there's probably there's at least six, and I think it's probably close to 10 or 12 that require amalgam separators. Seattle does. San Francisco, the city county of San Francisco does. New York does. Yeah, Maine and Vermont. Minnesota. In Minnesota, it was very interesting because the Minnesota Dental Association embraced the bill and supported it totally and were able within a year to get everybody in compliance with the amalgam separator mandate.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative McPherson and Burley. And
thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure whether that the question is best put to this panel, but I did want to focus in on the amendments that were put in the Senate. What was the rationale for picking, as far as anyone of you know, picking six of the Willamette watershed counties, but not all eight of them?
Actually, I expect Mr. Mason's going to be able to address that question better. It appeared to me when I saw those six counties that it was running down the Willamette, and that certainly doesn't capture all the ones running down the Columbia.
A follow-up?
Follow-up, if I could. And then just shifting over to the second piece that was amended in the Senate side, what are the best management practices for dental wastes by the Oregon Dental Association on the date of this? What does it say about the amalgam separator technology?
It's not included. And generally, BMPs are never going to include amalgam separators except under the ADA's guidelines. It says if your state requires amalgam separators, then it becomes part of the BMP.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Similar questions, and actually you raised another one. So if the ADA says if a state requires the amalgam separator, it becomes part of the BMP, then is the BMP that of the ADA and not the Oregon Dental Association? These are national?
They're pretty much adopting wholesale what the ADA's recommended BMPs are.
Okay, so follow-up.
Follow-up.
So the BMPs, the best management practices, on page 2 of the A. Engrossed bill, line 33, where it says, recommended by the Oregon Dental Association, these are actually American Dental Association best management practices?
I think if you match them up, you would see that they pretty much aligned. I don't know that there are any differences, and somebody else would probably be able to tell you that better than I. Those are on the ODA website. They're also on the ADA websites.
We have two people from ODA coming up, so we should,
right,
should ask them.
Well,
that.
I do, Madam Chair, if I may follow up again.
Follow up.
I do want to follow up some more, and I saw on the sign-up list we do have folks from the ADA, and so I'll reserve. I'd like to get into this BMP issue a little bit further, and mm-hmm. as my colleague asked, you know, why is 2013 a magic date for this? I'm also, and then I think I'll save this for the ODA witnesses as well, but just I really am curious. I mean, why, and I understand the toxicity of this material, but if you know, we've got it in our mouths now, how are we reacting to this? What's going on? So I'm a little curious about that relationship.
There's major health issues, and I did draft another bill that asked for it not to be placed in the mouths of children and pregnant women. That bill hasn't, you know, it isn't going anywhere this year. So this is the other bill that we were working on.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for coming in today. Next we have Nikki Terzioff, Brett Hamilton, and Doug Barber. Come up, please. Yeah. Can I say nothing right here?
Sure.
I'm digressing to fluoride up here. I don't think it's a slippery slope. Both of us grew up with fluoride, and we probably have
cavities.
A huge number of cavities in our mouth. Nikki, I'm sorry I didn't call you up earlier, so why don't we get started with
you?
Oh,
it's fine. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. I'm actually here. I'm going to introduce Brett Hamilton, who is the Oregon Dental Association, and will be able to, I think, to answer a lot of your questions and inquiries.
Great. Thank you, Brett. For the record.
For the record, my name is Brett Hamilton from the Oregon Dental Association, and thanks for having me here to speak with you. Now, I want to answer some of the questions that have been addressed. First of all, I want to clarify something. That seems to be a misinterpretation of what the dentists are about in Oregon. The dentists in Oregon aren't environmentalists also. They're not trying to pollute the water, not trying to hurt the fish, not trying to injure anyone. But I want to clarify that. I think that kind of gets mixed up once in a while. And so with that, I would like to talk a little about the BMP program and how it was developed. Now, the BMP program has been around since, I believe, 1998. Now, this program has been developed with a consortium of different folks, Clean Water Services, DEQ, the Oregon Dental Association. There was a group of people who came up with the BNP programs. And what we're doing is now, in the first phase, phase one of the program, is working with the dentists in the state to voluntarily agree to comply with following best management practices. Now, the data has come up. Why we're talking 2013? Well, phase one should be given a chance to succeed. And what happens in phase two is with 2012, phase two will bring in amalgam separators. Now, from around the country, especially let's talk about Washington State because that's our neighbor. They have amalgam separators, but they have found without a strong BNP program that really has the compliance component, the program is not that strong. So what a strong program needs is first it needs the compliance and needs to have the dentist on board, which we're going through phase one now. Phase two would be the second phase of the amalgam separators. Again, that's kind of that's the program we'd like to follow, and that's how we'd like to see it through. And since we've been working so closely and during this process with the Washoe Tribe and with DEQ, Clean Water Services, and Board of Dentistry, we felt what we brought forth was what we agreed to and we felt was the best bill possible. Now, ODA will support and is supporting this bill, but we'd like to make sure it's the best bill possible. And it's things are clarified and things are just the best we can do. One of the things that I guess the ODA would like to ensure is that when we go through with this and amalgam separators are mandated put in place, that we make sure it's a good bill so 2 years from now, 4 years from now, there's not a request to add on to maybe have the next new equipment. So next year, a new amalgam separator comes out, and it's the top of the line, everyone says that there won't be another bill in place asking for the requirement to then mandate the replacement of the machine. So I'd like to close this saying that BODA is supportive of the bill. We're supportive of a clean environment, and we would like to see the BNP program operate the way it was to operate through phase one, and then we can move to phase two.
I was going to say just a couple of quick questions before we move on to hear Doug. One is, are you supportive, because when you signed up here, you said with the Dash 4s. I have not seen the Dash 4s, and nobody else up here has seen the Dash 4s. So could you maybe let us know what would be in the Dash 4s that you would be supportive?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. The Dash 4s, I'll put in my air quotes,
amendments, yes.
are more of a conceptual offer. The Dash 3s, as you all are aware, were not everything we had hoped for, or perhaps a little more than we had wanted. And so what we'd like to see happen with this conceptual amendment is that the pieces of Dash 3 that we'd like to incorporate along with the Dash 2s get folded into one change so that we can create that best bill possible with one stroke.
And would that include all counties? Because there was a
it would go back to statewide, yes. Okay.
And you're supportive of that. And one final question, and we'll go on to Doug, and we'll take questions from the whole committee. Is regarding is there's no, I mean, who determines as far as the dental separator, you know, the actual physical separator? I mean, it doesn't seem like it's spelled out in here. So that's something that through your BMPs, do you recommend certain types of separators?
Yes, Chair Dinkler, the ADA actually recommends separators. And that's how it's followed through. I also like just to make a quick comment about how the BMPs came about. Actually, the BMPs, as I mentioned before, were established through the Oregon Environmental Council. That's the group that worked on it. Mm-hmm. And through that, the ADA has actually adopted Oregon's BMP program. We are a national example of how a program works. This is a voluntary compliance program. And it's used as a model throughout the nation of what should be done. And I'd just like to make a quick point that I think that's how things should work. If we can get folks voluntarily comply to things without having the government to step in to mandate, that's what I think should be always our first attempt. And so I just like to point out that this is a national model, and we're quite proud of it, and we just accept for the record.
Great, thank you. ahead, Doug.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I'm Doug Barber here today on behalf of Willamette Dental Group. For those of you who don't know, Willamette Dental Group is a large group practice that's based in Hillsboro, Oregon. We have 27 dental offices in Oregon. We also have dental offices in Washington, Idaho, and Nevada. And Willamette Dental, as actually in conjunction with the Oregon Dental Association's Best Practice Act, began installing amalgam separators in 2004. We finished doing it in all 51 of our offices in 2005. So we've done what I think the intent of this bill is suggesting, and it was a voluntary program, as Brett said. Well, so our concern isn't about the requirement for installing that's in the bill. Our concern is about the reporting requirements that are in the bill, which seem onerous and sort of convoluted. There's models out there, even with like the X-ray equipment that we use in our dental offices, where they have to be installed to code. There's standards for the installation. They have to be inspected on a regular basis, but you don't have to mail in forms every 6 months that's going to sit in somebody's inbox, and it's not each dentist personally responsible. I mean, we have in our 27 offices more than 50 dentists, and some of them move between offices. So whatever the final reporting requirements are in this bill, we're just trying to figure out a way to make them workable for a large group practice like ours, so that it's really the company that installed the separators. The company is the one that is responsible for making sure that the maintenance happens. It's not what if a dentist comes into our Albany office to work one day a week on pediatric dental cases, they're not thinking about, gee, I hope the amalgam separator is working today because I've got a vouch for that at the end of this 6 month period on some form. This bill so far has been kind of a moving target. I keep sending things to the folks at Willamette Dental to take a look at them, but it's always waiting for the next set of amendments to figure out what's really there. So what I would ask of the committee is just that we have enough time once we actually see what we hope are final amendments to be able to run them by people to make sure that it's a solution that works and doesn't penalize companies like ours that have already taken the kind of action that you're hoping to encourage others to take.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Burley.
Thank you. Brett, I'm not sure I quite understood you. With the phase one, phase two, you said that the phase two, starting in 2012, would require the amalgam separators. Is that correct?
Yes, that's how I understand it, yes.
Okay, so right now, phase one does not require that. And
that's correct. It's still a voluntary compliance program when the dentist will sign up with the program and basically comply with the agreement. And we actually have once a year, we have a mercury recycling event, a collection event at our annual conference. And most dentists are bringing in their liquid mercury and the mercury to recycle. And we also in the BNP programs offer a whole list of recyclers, people that will pick up from their office, people we can mail in, assortment of all sorts of opportunities to recycle. And just one comment, I know it's a little rushed in my testimony, but this year we actually have an intern, when we have collected a lot of data from the dentists around the state, and this intern is coming from Aqua, and they will be inputting our data that we've collected from the dentist, and we'll really be able to see a look of how the BNP program's been working. And we're anxious, as everyone else, to prove that the program is working and to show that with the data that we'll be pulling together this summer.
Okay.
Follow up.
Brett, where I was going with this is I'm curious, why did the ODA in developing this phase one, phase two, pick 2012 to implement the separators? Why not sooner?
Actually, I'm not aware of the reason that was said. As I was saying, it was agreed upon by a group of coming together for the phase one, phase two. I'm not sure why the 2012. I do know that the thought process was to give the phase one an opportunity to succeed, and then once that phase ran through, to go into the phase of the program. I'm sorry I can't answer that more fully, but I can definitely get the answer to that, as well as a copy of the VMPs if you have not seen those already.
Well, a follow-up on that, because I'm curious, since you had 27 dentist offices complied within a year, I'm just curious why. I mean, that's you know, 5 years out, and it doesn't seem like, I mean, they did their entire practice in 1 year, so I'm curious about why that got pushed out to 2013. I was sort of a little surprised when I saw the date in the amended bill.
Well, the date, the 2013, was to come a year after the phase two of the program. And as I stated, the ODA is not not supportive of the bill as offered. But when they're coming to the dates, I'll have to ask actually the people involved in pulling the BNP program together, which I was not one of them, to find out how that date came about.
Please, if I may.
Yeah.
Doug, you mentioned some concern about the reporting requirements being biannual, as opposed to those requirements that you have now for inspection, certification of X-ray, and other types of equipment. Could you elaborate on that a little bit? And is there a way that, if we're going to be amending this bill, we might be able to amend this so it is consistent with and part of, so you're not having extra processes?
Yeah, I think, and in the dash threes, which I understand are a piece of something, it gets at a part of that. What we, you know, they are, I believe, our amalgam separators are inspected. Some of them are inspected twice a year. Some are inspected once a year, and it depends on the community that they're in. I don't quite understand that distinction, but they keep those maintenance reports at the office, just like you would for your X-ray equipment or your elevator or whatever else you have. And if you know, in the case of the X-ray equipment, it's the public health division that comes in and does inspections, and they can look at your records and make sure that your equipment works properly. And that's what we would think makes sense in this case too, is that if we have, you know, we keep our maintenance records, they're there, they're available, and if whoever the appropriate agency is, whether that's DEQ or somebody, wants to do an audit and they want to come in and take a look at our records and make sure that we're maintaining them properly, then we're happy to show them. But it just seems to us to be onerous to be mailing forms to somebody, especially the original bill, which was the Board of Dentistry, and that's not at all what they're set up to do. Nobody's going to sit there and check off, make sure every dentist has got their six-month maintenance requirement fulfilled, in my opinion.
Any other questions? Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brett, I guess I confess to being still a little bit mystified. If we were to get rid of the BMP amendment, so go back to the original bill, what would be the effect on dentists? I mean, why would you oppose that? I haven't heard you say, I've heard that the reporting requirements are onerous, and perhaps we should be looking at that. But given that you're moving eventually to this, these separators in every office, why should we not do that sooner rather than later? What's the burden, the cost? I'm not hearing those issues.
Chair Dingfeld, Representative Canada, what the costs are, and we haven't gotten to that since we're in the minutia here, the cost of the actually separators is not that great when you take the separator by itself. Now, if you're talking about old medical buildings and you're talking about and some other buildings such as that, when the infrastructure does not allow for separators, so they don't have room or the different piping, you could be talking major costs to dental practices. That's one area. I think the major point I think I'd like to make is, again, without a strong BMP program, without an established BMP program, the separators are not going to get us much relief from mercury. The BMP programs, and analyzes, that covers 80% of the mercury. We're talking about the big chunks that get caught in the traps that we're talking about recycling. Now, we have separators. You're talking about additional, yes, we're talking about additionally removing mercury. We're talking about the minute dust more. We're not talking about the big chunks. So my point being, the BMP program being the point is that you get a strong program first. You get people in compliance removing the larger chunks. The separator comes in after you have that established and cleans up the minutiae, the smaller dust. And then we can say we're being effective in the program. But without that, with this separators, you're catching the dust, but if someone's not taking care of the traps by their chair where they're collecting the bulk of the mercury, then you're no real better off than you were before.
Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. I appreciate the clarification. Would it be possible for you to provide the committee with some sort of documentation about the BMP program?
Yes.
I'm interested in seeing that. Thank
yes.
you.
That would be helpful. Okay, Representative Smith had a question, and we'll come back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I ask my question, I just want to point out that there's many, many industries around the state of Oregon that have environmental compliance requirements that aren't required to report to the state. And so to me, this seems like we're overthinking this issue and we're creating a cumbersome requirement for Oregon's small business owners who are in the dental arena. With that said, on page 2, line 19, there's talk that the board would have the ability to increase your licensing fees to accommodate this new environmental compliance requirements. What's your folks' take on that?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. Representative Smith, I can make a couple of clarifications, I suppose. It's unfortunate that we all don't have the Dash 3 amendments to look at, and you'll see in there a lot of the questions that are arising, coming up, I think, have been answered in the negotiations and in the conversation. The board will, with these amendments, properly, the board will not necessarily have the ability to raise fees for dentists. But the reporting requirements are less stringent. And what we start looking at are maintenance logs, you know, keeping available a maintenance log in case of an audit for DEQ or a special water district. If they want to come in and do that, the dentist has to have that available, has to be able to make that available. And then if they can't make it available, or if the log is reporting a faulty machine, or somebody's not following the BMPs, then it would be the board, and I believe the director of the board is here to testify today as well, then it would be the board that gets to come in and kind of play that offensive role.
In the collection of this mercury, I assume that there's someone in the private sector that collects this stuff from the small business owners. Wouldn't they be able to say who and who is not returning mercury? It's going to be a return product.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Smith, I imagine.
So yes. To me, just following the logic, to me it seems like there's a way to ensure environmental compliance without putting an onerous requirement on the small business owner.
Thank you. Do you have another question before we call up the last witness?
Yeah, just a couple real quickly. One, going back to the phase one, phase two, and in response to some questions from Representative Cannon, sorry, getting ahead of myself.
Don't demote me.
There's a senator in the audience.
Yeah.
Sorry. new offices versus retrofit. If I were going to go into the practice of dentistry myself and build a new office building for my practice, would the BMPs necessarily require that in that new office, the plumbing, et cetera, be put in with the amalgam separator?
Chair Dingfelder and Representative Burley, there would not be a requirement. It would be advisable to do that with the knowledge that in the future that would be required. We're also hoping in the future that standard dental equipment will have amalgam separators with them.
Okay. And then lastly, Madam Chair, if I may, thank you. How much of this gets into the wastewater now? I mean, that mercury occurs naturally. We have issues with it in East Lake and fish contamination. And I'm just curious, have we actually, and I see we've got somebody from DEQ here perhaps might want to address this, how much of this stuff actually gets into the system today? And also to follow up with that, my question earlier is, if it's so toxic when it's in the waste or in the drinking water, for example, or in the fish that we consume, why is it not toxic to us when they put it in our mouth? or is it? Am I suffering something I'm not aware of?
You seem fine to me.
You haven't been here very long, obviously.
Perhaps I should let someone in the DQ answer the percentage-wise, but I'll do my best from what I know. From my understanding, it's of all the mercury load, it's 1%. And, you know, it's there. Obviously, when things in the air and elsewhere fall, it does fall into water either. Also, so to answer, it's a small percentage, but, it is a percentage, and we really want to clean up our environment, and that's important. But my broader point is that there are a lot more polluters of mercury and sources of mercury than the dentist. And I know that we're trying to get at every bit and piece, but I think a lot of times the amalgam is the low-hanging fruit, and it's easy to get at. And so if this is a step forward that we can move forward and to and I guess my point is to put at rest that the dental amalgams entering the water, so we can go after larger sources, and that's a good deal. Now, for the amalgam in our mouths, just recently this year, there's been a new study indicating once again that amalgam is safe in your mouth. Although we're seeing a phasing out of that practice and seeing more composite and things, it is safe. And on the issue of getting amalgam removed from mouths and actually even using the material, that has to be done at the federal level. Medicaid, Medicare patients, they only can receive amalgam. They will not receive composites or anything else. So on that level, that's more of a federal level of actually seeing the end of use of amalgam.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, and it sounds like we will have some dash fours coming up, and I hope you'll take a look at those, and we'll be back. Thanks. And we have one last witness, Patrick. I can't read your last name, Patrick. With the Oregon Board of Dentistry. Thank you, Patrick. And I see you also have said you support it with the mystery amendment. So
with the mystery amendment. Yes. Thank you, Chair Dingenfelder. For the record, my name is Patrick Brodson. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry. And I actually do have some written comments here. Which basically comment on the mystery amendments, as you want to call them. I testified when the bill was before the Senate that actually this is not something that should be in the purview of the Board of Dentistry. We're not into environmental or water quality issues per se and having to regulate them, as Mr. Barber had mentioned, and having a lot of paper coming in and being filled in. We think that the bill obviously is important in trying to get mercury out of the water system. We think the process that has been developed by the Oregon Dental Association with the best business practices is probably the way to do it, and to do it in a phased-in basis. One of the questions that was asked earlier is, you know, why not have it happen tomorrow or the next? I happen to use mass transit in Portland and go by the Oregon or the Portland Medical Dental Building almost every day. That building was built in the 1920s. In order for you to mandate amalgam separators to go into that office, I don't even want to venture what the cost will be to those practices. They will either have to close or totally spend thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to redo the plumbing. So that's one of the reasons why the phase-in is the dental office that I go to in Newburgh is just a single structure, and yes, it'd be very easy to put amalgam separators in and do it in a very quickly fashion, but that's not the way everything is in all of the buildings, and so I think that's why one of the phase-ins were built into the process. From the board standpoint, we're willing to work with any of the state agencies that need to regulate this and work with them in getting it up and running and give whatever assistance necessary. But it's really not within our purview to be trying to regulate, because it would be very difficult. For example, as Mr. Barber mentioned, we regulate dentists. We don't regulate the facilities. So we don't have an actual listing of all the facilities. And this bill, as it was originally intended, was that they were going to have to send in by any reports all the dentists twice a year, very expensive. In regards to the licensing fees, our fiscal note was that we're going to have to raise the fees at least $40 a biennium to cover the cost of the extra paperwork and the extra staff. I might also add, as Representative Burley, I do have some of those silver fillings in my mouth. I have approximately six of them. Today's my birthday. I'm 46 years old, and I've only ever had two of them replaced. So I guess they do last a little longer than 15 years, because most of them were put in when I was in my teens. So I think you're okay. I don't know, but listening to the chair, she's not so sure. No, I'm just kidding. Anyway, we're supportive of what will come out, and I think conceptual in the Dash 4, removing us from a major role in the process, because it just isn't really what we're into. So I'll be more than happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank Thanks. You very much. Appreciate your input. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 704, and we will, I think, hopefully have amendments in front of us by Wednesday. With that, I'm going to – I'm sorry, that was the public hearing. Mm-hmm. I was closing, not a work session, and I was saying hopefully we'll have a work session on Wednesday with the amendments. I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 375, and I see we have Senator Walker here that I think would like to say a few comments. Welcome. Thanks for coming here. I know you have a very big, busy schedule, and I know that you helped with this bill in the interim, so we really appreciate it.
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, and I think this is the first time I've been in front of your committee. You have a little Tweety bird
yes.
in your microphone.
Yes, that's
it must be your Mercury. So this is the way to keep you in line, Representative
yeah.
Burley. We just hold you still. Don't make a move.
If I get fidgeting too much, it's okay.
Don't give him too much coffee. Well, I enjoy coming into your committee.
It's entertaining, entertaining, always.
It is entertaining. Well, as you said, Madam Chair, this bill came from the Interim Committee on what was my committee? Natural Resources and Alternative Energy that I chaired. And in 2005, actually, some of you who were here in 2005, I think Representative Cannon is our only new person, will remember that we passed a bill to cover 11 appliances. Well, now we've come back with an additional 7. But what I actually like about this bill is that in Section 7 of the bill, you'll notice that we give the Department of Energy rules to develop some standards by rule in the future. So we don't have to keep coming back to the legislature and adding appliances and making changes that we need to do as technology improves. Really, the most important thing to remember here is that energy efficiency and conservation is, simply put, the fastest and cheapest way to cut our dependence on fossil fuels and reduce energy bills for consumers and businesses. The 7 products that we are adding this session are pretty common appliances such as water coolers, CD players, and DVD players, and hot tubs, though my hot tub is broken, so it's not doing much of anything right now. These things produce what is called phantom load, and ever since I learned about phantom load, now I go around the house and I unplug my appliances, and then my husband goes to use them, and he says, why isn't this working? Plug it in. But I realized that they suck quite a bit of energy. Each individual appliance just does a small bit, but as you have all of these appliances through your house, if they're plugged in, they're sucking energy. Of course, there are new methods of production now, which is why we're bringing these new appliances to you. California has adopted these standards already for CD players and DVD players, so don't be fooled if the Electronics Association comes forward and tells you we don't need to do this in Oregon, because California is already doing that, and you can't it's quite easy to do it here for Oregon as well. So actually, I'm just here to tell you we can save a bundle of money. There is a mystery amendment, though it's not a mystery to anyone, because I did represent on the floor of the Senate when I carried this bill, that we would remove the furnace provision in the bill. That's giving people some angst, and I think there's a different way of approaching it than going through this route. But as long as the federal government fails to do what it needs to do on a national level, we have to take it matters into our own hands, Madam Chair, and that's why you have Senate Bill 375 in front of you. I'm happy to answer any questions before I finally scoot off to my committee that started over an hour ago.
Thank you, Senator, for your leadership. I appreciate it. And Representative Jensen and I were co-sponsors of House Bill 3363 last time, and we appreciated your support last time on that. So I will see if there's any questions before we send you back over to your committee.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you
Great.
So much for coming today. With that, I'd like to call up the Department of Energy, Betty Merrill, and then Doug Johnson and Kenton Irwin. I know that they both came from far away. So do you want to... I was going to call you all up together, but I want to make sure we got the Department of Energy up here first to see if there is any specific questions. And Betty, if you can just walk us through a little bit through the bill, I think that would be helpful for the committee, and then we'll, before we hear the witnesses.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Betty Merrill from the Oregon Department of Energy. Basically walking you through the bill, there are six new products being added to the list of products that are currently regulated in Oregon. A dozen states have adopted standards for these products, including California, Oregon, and Washington. The department is supporting the bill with the exception of the residential furnace, the mystery amendment. The three reasons we are recommending the deletion of the residential furnace from the bill is, one, the 90% furnace efficiency for retrofit situations can be very costly because of the type of ventilation required. Second reason is that the Oregon Department of Energy is working in collaboration with a number of our stakeholders to improve the current Oregon Residential Energy Code by 15%. In that proposal, we have one of the methods of meeting that 15% energy efficiency is by utilizing the 90% efficient furnace. However, it's not a requirement. There are other alternatives to meeting the standard. And the third reason is that when we adopt an appliance standard such as furnaces that is higher than the U.S. DOE, U.S. Department of Energy standard, we have to go through what's called a preemption process, and that will take us some time and some effort to do. So we feel if we go through the preemption process, it will take us till approximately 2012 to get the preemption. If we go through the code process where we would allow the 90% efficiency furnace as an option, we would be able to do that by potentially next summer.
And one question I had about the timing of the adoption of these, because we did have a little glitch last time, as you know.
Correct.
And we tried to make sure that the implementation date was consistent with California's implementation date. So could you comment on the implementation date in this bill?
Yeah, I believe that there is also a mystery amendment that's being offered to make sure that the dates are in line.
Thank you. And finally, what percentage of the market does Oregon hold versus California? Because that came up as an issue last time. And why we even needed this when California was driving the market?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the issue with Oregon adopting standards, particularly California, Oregon, and Washington, try to align. And we, if Oregon adopted the standards with about 2% of the population of the country, we probably wouldn't get very far. But following with California and Washington, we do have a large, sizable portion of the market. So.
Thank you. And committee members, last session when we debated and discussed this bill, that question came up. Why do we need the bill here in Oregon if California is the driver? And the concern was with California and Washington adopting these standards, we didn't want Oregon to become a dumping ground for the less efficient appliances, and that was a concern. And thus, being consistent was a priority, making sure that we were not then taking less efficient appliances or having them dumped from the California or Washington market here.
Madam Chair, that is correct. And one of the things I'd like to add is that when you adopted 3363, you had 11 appliances. Since that time, with the Energy Policy Act of 2005, the feds passed standards for six products. So we no longer have special standards on six products. As California adopts standards, there's such a large market. When the whole left coast goes, the feds eventually will meet those standards because the manufacturers don't want to be producing appliances for many different standards.
Okay. Thank you. Good questions for the department? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just stick around. We might have some more questions that come up. Doug Johnson and Kenton Irwin. Al, we're sort of just getting in it, too.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Doug Johnson, Senior Director of Technology Policy for the Consumer Electronics Association. We're a high-tech trade association representing about 2,100 companies nationally and about 35 in Oregon. As our written testimony is being handed out, let me just cut to the chase and highlight three key points. The standards, the elements of this bill that we're concerned about have to do with the provisions for compact audio products and DVD players and recorders. First of all, these provisions are unnecessary. Energy Star is working and always has exceeded these levels already in the bill. Secondly, this bill would create new regulations but not save energy for these product categories. Finally, setting limits on high-tech products in this way hurts innovation and could actually increase energy use over time, and I'll explain this in my testimony. First of all, these products have been added to the bill, which, of course, primarily focuses on industrial commercial appliances. Electronics are vastly different in what they do for consumers and how they're made, what's inside of them, how they work, features, functions, and so forth. So they're very different types of products as opposed to electromechanical devices. We are concerned that placing artificial limits on products could hurt innovation and increase energy use. If you set an artificial limit on a product in our industry, you limit what that product can do in the future. And frankly, you know, we have no idea what's coming around the corner in 2, 5, 10 years. And so we found that the best approach for saving energy is not through this route. Again, we strongly support energy conservation and efficiency, but we achieve that through the Energy Star program nationally. Placing an artificial cap on a product limits what that product can do in the future. And to the extent that consumers want features A, B, C, and D, if they can't be provided in a product with that limit or that meets a given limit, consumers will buy products that connect together. In other words, instead of a converged product, which we often see in the marketplace nowadays, you'll have an out-migration of features and functions into other products so that, you know, a given product could meet that artificial limit. So that placing standards and limits on products is just not the best approach for achieving energy efficiency. Fortunately, there is a better way, and that is through Energy Star. And I've included in our testimony some description of what Energy Star has achieved for compact audio and DVD products already. You'll see in those graphs, in particular at the bottom of page 3, an indication of where we're at today and where we were at several years ago. I've heard a lot about, well, we're just following California. And while that may be true in some other areas of this bill, on the compact audio and DVD products, actually nobody's following California. I've listed the states in there. There are 7 or 8 of them that have rejected mandatory limits on high-tech products for good reason. There is a better way, as I mentioned, that's Energy Star. And so we've highlighted what that program has meant in terms of greenhouse gas reductions and kilowatt hours saved. And we would point to that as the best way of achieving it. For 15 years, our industry and our member companies have worked with Energy Star on a variety of product categories, including audio and DVD, to set specifications which are voluntary. But the program has worked well because manufacturers participate at high levels. And over time, Energy Star has to ratchet down those specifications to, again, tease the market onward toward more efficient levels and standby power. And it's worked great. And so we've highlighted those accomplishments on page 4 in our testimony. Finally, on page 5 are those states and those bills where energy efficiency standards for compact audio and DVD were rejected. Again, this is not about saying no to standards. It's about saying that there's a better way of achieving this. And if you set standards on these products, first of all, it doesn't save energy, and that's most important. But secondly, it could adversely impact innovation and actually increase energy use given this artificial constraint in a product. So we would urge you to take a second look at those provisions concerning compact audio and DVD. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have today. Thanks very much.
Okay, right, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Kenton Irwin. I'm General Counsel of VTEC. VTEC is an Oregon corporation that's been here since the 1970s, and we're the sales office for the headquarters in China that manufactures consumer electronic devices. And we're just here in support of the CEA today, and I'd like to say the VTEC considers itself a green company. We've got 28 of our products certified under the Energy Star program and working on more. We're also coming into compliance with the California Energy Commission's energy efficiency standards, which I believe Oregon has adopted. And also our products comply with the ROHS standards, R-O-H-S, which are based in Europe, I think, and they're some of the world's most strict contamination guidelines on how much lead you can have or mercury in your products. And we strongly support the position of the CEA, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Cannon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. How have the California standards impacted your industry?
And I assume you mean for compact audio and DVD. They've had no impact. They've increased cost and administrative burdens on manufacturers because they have reporting and record-keeping requirements with them. But as they've been implemented in the marketplace, they have not saved energy. But it's not a surprise because as you look at what underlay those standards to begin with, it was old data, almost 10-year-old data about how much energy these products use. So the California Energy Commission did analysis and said, we'd save this much energy if we could just set this limit. Well, it's not true. We've blown through that already as a result of Energy Star. So the impact in terms of energy savings is not there. But a practical impact, it increases costs for manufacturers, record-keeping requirements, which obviously are unnecessary. The spirit of this is saving energy. It's not encumbering manufacturers and the way to do business.
If we did promulgate standards here that resulted in energy saving, would you then support them? Is your opposition based on the fact that it doesn't result in energy savings, or is it just a sort of opposition to standards that add compliance costs for you?
If setting standards were the only way, we'd have to talk about what could work and what could make the marketplace transform. But we're also here to say that there is a better way. It is working. It is driving down standby power, which is what the focus is here. And it's called Energy Star. And it's not only helping Oregon consumers. It's covering the whole nation. And it really provides a better approach. So, again, we're not here to say, you know, no regulations, no standards. We're saying we're making this, you know, 15-year-old contribution to Energy Star. It's working for these categories like others. And let's focus on that. Let's find out ways to support and enhance Energy Star rather than, you know, limiting innovation and consumer products.
Thanks.
Questions over here?
Thank you,
Madam
Chair.
I'm just wondering if folks can check their cell phone or BlackBerry because it does affect our audio, and it seems like somebody is buzzing a lot in addition to my vice chair.
It's
his amalgam, yeah. That's that's what they say, don't they? You can hear the radio or something. And by the way, Representative Jensen's not here because he's at the dentist, so sort of appropriate.
You've given us a list of states that have rejected, and I guess I'm curious how many states actually have implemented standards.
California is the only one so far. You might hear that New York is considering this, and that's true. New York had a bill that gave a directive to a state agency that said to go out and consider standards for this list of products and come up with them. They have not done so yet for our products, and I don't think in the end they're going to have standards because their consultants looked at California and realized, well, if we follow California, we don't save energy. So this issue, as it is in New York, is still in play, but the only state that has done anything has been California. But those regulations, as I mentioned in my testimony, have been problematic. In other areas, for example, there's a product that they regulated in the consumer electronics realm that they're going to withdraw the regulation for soon. That's digital television adapters. They've made significant amendments to external power supply regulations there. So they really didn't get it right, and that's what we wanted to highlight, is that, you know, it makes sense sometimes to follow a lead, but this is not the leading example here to follow.
I have a question for you. As far as the cost of these products, what has been the cost increase that you've seen in California?
Again, the California regulations for compact audio and DVD products, as we've surveyed our members about the impact, do not appear to have saved energy. Therefore, the cost-benefit analysis that was put forth to support these regs in the first place is what we focused on. California said, well, consumers should save this energy and it should be this efficient. And they gave the numbers for cost-benefit analysis and net present value. It was all based on old energy data for these products. We'd exceeded that already, so it was kind of a false argument for energy savings, and therefore the net, you know, the cost-benefit analysis was flawed there. So there is no, and I imagine that, like in Oregon and other, as in other states, that the analysis that's offered up to support these regulations is the same analysis we've seen in California and other states that have initially considered this and later rejected it.
So maybe I'm just not understanding this correctly, but if what I'm hearing you say is that there, the standards that have been set, you're already exceeding.
Yes.
So then why are you opposed to standards that you're already exceeding? That's what I'm sort of at a loss at.
For two main reasons. One, this initiative, this bill, this legislation, and frankly our industry's efforts are focused on energy efficiency and savings. This is not about savings in this bill for these products. It's about setting regulations that are unnecessary because the marketplace exceeds that already. So if you do look at a current cost-benefit analysis, it would not be justified because the savings aren't there in the first place. The second major concern we have is innovation. You limit what a product can do in our industry, and it's our artificial constraint innovation. Consumers in the future may want several features that cannot be provided at that limit. So there's the workaround is sell more products, and as a whole, they may end up using more energy than that product would have in its natural state, you know, under the Energy Star program. So the impact on innovation, the lack of energy savings, I think are two big reasons why it does not make sense for these two product categories to set energy use limits.
Well, I appreciate you, your input, and I appreciate you coming here. We heard the same arguments last time, and I have to say that I was sort of similarly perplexed because we haven't seen with adoption. I mean, I've been following in California, and, you know, I hear conflicting views about, you know, the effectiveness. So we will certainly be talking to the folks in California and getting the information from them as well.
Appreciate it.
Representative Burley?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. I think it would be helpful, certainly for me, and I apologize if you've already touched on this and I might have missed it in your testimony, but if you could briefly explain what is it about the Energy Star program as opposed to these types of standards? What compare and contrast the two, and why is the Energy Star program better for innovation, especially on products that have such a short turnaround time, if you will?
Sure. There are several good reasons why Energy Star is the better path toward achieving energy savings. It's flexible. It responds to the marketplace much faster. Sure, it's voluntary, but it teases all companies, all products, toward greater efficiency levels over time. It aims to target the top 25%, and then as that proportion of the products out there increases, they set a new limit. So it's focused on the market. It adjusts over time quickly. Our products are always changing and converging. What's more, Energy Star, as it develops specifications, appreciates that it's really hard to define products. What's compact audio and DVD today might not be the same tomorrow. Features merge and blend, and things are always changing. So that's why Energy Star over the past 15-plus years has been so successful in keeping pace with this energy and, again, meeting that public policy goals of saving energy and conserving in the products.
Follow up?
Sure.
Does the Energy Star only apply to compact audio products and digital versatile disc players, or are there more consumer electronic goods than just those?
There are many more, actually. There are probably more than 20 product categories in electronics covering residential office equipment and commercial office equipment, home audio and video products. It really spans the bulk of our industry. And if you walk into your local electronics retailer, it's not hard to find in every major product category in our industry, Energy Star. And that's another merit of it, by the way, is that it provides a label and a signal to consumers. I think two-thirds of consumers recognize the Energy Star label, and that helps decision-making, point of sale. So it's been very successful for consumers as well.
I could call up some more people.
One more question, if I may.
Final question.
So if the standards as proposed in Senate Bill 375, if your folks don't support these, what would you feel about instead mandating compliance with Energy Star in Oregon?
Sure, and it's a natural question. If it works so well, let's make it mandatory for everything. Unfortunately, that would undermine the program. The merit and the strength of the program comes from its voluntary nature. There is an out. If you come up with an innovative new product and it can't quite meet that Energy Star spec that's out there today, maybe it'll meet it tomorrow, but you can still deliver that innovation to consumers today. So making Energy Star mandatory all of a sudden changes the nature of the program, and its strength really is in that voluntary participation. It's not just industry at the table developing these specs. It's all stakeholders who have an interest in energy saving. So it's a real round table of stakeholders that come up with these limits, but making them mandatory would really undermine that. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. I know you have a plane to catch.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, Representative McPherson.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This may be, I'm going to try to penetrate a little more deeply into the sort of issue that we've been kind of focusing on here, which is why is it that these restrictions, if your products are already in compliance because of the technological innovations and the Energy Star program, why it's troublesome to have this put in place, this set of restrictions, if you're already doing better than this? And the only argument I think I was hearing was that it would suppress innovation, that is the opportunity to add more features, which apparently would consume more energy. Is that the argument, that you want to be able to ramp up the capabilities and thereby that might exceed the standard?
Yeah, I mean, there are two reasons for it, first of all, but innovation is a major concern for us. If you set these limits on products, you limit what they can do for consumers. And while today that might be all right, tomorrow, who knows? Some features that consumers want simply take energy. And what's more, the nature of convergence means that what two or three products did in the past, one product can do for you now. But if that product is limited, then you've also set a limit on convergence in the future. And convergence has its own efficiency as well. There's a natural driver for saving energy in our industry. You have to reduce heat emissions as things get smaller and smaller. Heat is the enemy of long life in electronic components. So as we converge and pull all these things into one device, a lot of attention is paid to reducing energy apart from Energy Star to begin with. So the natural convergence actually is a driver for energy efficiency, but the impact on innovation by mandatory standards like this is pretty serious and could actually, as I mentioned, increase energy use if it divides products up in the future and you have to buy more than one to get what you want.
Follow up if I could.
Quick follow up. We have a whole list of people to testify still.
Very briefly. Is there specific provision of the bill that is the obstacle, the problem that your product line wouldn't be able to meet? I mean, I happen to see this on page 8, reference here in lines 27 to 30 to digital versatile disc players that have a 3-watt standard in standby passive mode. Is that the provision, or are there other provisions here in the bill that are the particular obstacle for you?
I realize it's a minority of the bill, but the specific provisions are those concerning compact audio products and DVD players and recorders. Those two provisions are paragraphs.
And can you reference me to a particular bill language?
Sure. Actually, I had a copy. I'm afraid I gave it to a colleague just before I stepped up here.
We
but
can get that for you.
I can get that for you.
I want to take up the committee's time here on this. I'm just trying to get...
Basically, anywhere where it's referenced, I think that's what they're referring to.
No, I'm trying to find where it's referenced.
Well, partially it's on... Yeah, partially it's on, as you pointed out, page 8 in section 14.
14 compact audio products would be okay.
Yep.
The 2 watts in standby. So that's the problem. Is the 2 watts in standby passive mode?
Yeah. For DVD, I believe it's 3, and for compact audio, it's 2 or 4, depending on features.
Gotcha. Okay. But again, so that's the problem. You want to be able to exceed those standards with innovations.
Right. Right. And they're unnecessary, as I mentioned. They don't save energy. They hurt innovation.
Yeah.
That's
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate you coming here today.
Free time.
Okay. I'm going to just call up a panel. It doesn't necessarily mean that they have the same views, but just to move through this and get out of here by 3 o'clock before we get kicked out. I will ask Jeremiah Bauman, Julie Brandes, and Jim Craven. Come up, please. The dynamic trio.
Jim and I agree.
Okay.
Right.
Jeremiah, why don't you get started?
The whole phalanx of views coming up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremiah Bauman with Osperg, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. Senator Walker covered very well sort of the big picture reasons for this bill, energy efficiency. Well, it doesn't quite get the excitement and energy that wind turbines and solar panels get, is actually the more effective way to reduce our fossil fuel dependence and all the problems that go along with that. I will jump quickly to the more technical components of the bill. I'm handing around 2 charts. One chart, the kind of full-page chart, shows other states that have adopted the standards that are in this bill. It also, just to make things confusing, includes three standards that were adopted in last year's bill. But you can see there's a range of states that are either have adopted most of these standards or are considering them. They've all been adopted in multiple states, with the exception of the compact audio and DVD products that have only been adopted in California. I'm also handing out this chart to dispel the myth that we're always only following California. In some cases, it's Maryland and New York as well that are ahead of us, unfortunately. As you can see here on the left, there are seven products in the bill right now. Bottle-type water dispensers is translated into English as water coolers, like the one sitting up behind the dais there. We actually managed to change the hot tubs, which in the technical policy wants to speak was, I believe, called portable electric spas. A couple of important things to know about this bill. The second chart, the horizontal chart, shows a ton of numbers, and it's a little bit hard to read. You can spend half an hour trying to figure it out. I'll highlight the important ones from it, which is that these standards save enough electricity by 2020 in the state of Oregon to power about 18,000 households worth of electricity use. And the furnace standards alone save enough natural gas to power 28,000 households worth of natural gas. By 2030, that adds up to a total savings, after accounting for the increased price of the product, of about $264 million. There's also some interesting information on this chart, so I'll let you think about that. Two issues have come up in the course of the debate on this bill. The one that Senator Walker mentioned is the residential furnaces. The chart, if you look at the second column from the left on the chart, shows the incremental cost per unit, so how much the price for a product goes up because of the energy efficiency standard. Residential furnaces go up by about $373. I don't believe that that does account for the cost of installation, which also goes up when you're retrofitting, when you're replacing an existing furnace. So you're not building a new house or doing a big remodeling, you're just replacing your furnace. The 90% efficiency furnaces have higher installation costs because they require different ductwork.
For a moment, please. Jeremiah, I just want to make sure we're clear about one thing. This chart you gave us doesn't have any source by which you're attributing this data to. Where's this coming from?
This comes from the Appliance Standards Awareness Project. It was a project of the American Council on an Energy Efficient Economy, which is data productions that take the technical standards from the manufacturers and apply those to Oregon-specific situations. So everything from temperature, when you're taking into account how many days the average Oregonian uses heat, to where our electricity comes from, to calculate what both the cost savings would be and what the emissions benefits would be. And I can get you a more. This is partially without a source because I took their data and
modified it. Well, I was just curious if it was Jeremiah's numbers or something else.
There's no Osprey in a basement. Right. Osprey intern in a basement somewhere who knows how to test furnaces for gas consumption, to my knowledge at least. So there are a couple of issues that come up with the furnaces. The other issue that Senator Walker mentioned is that the way that appliance standards work under federal law is that if the Department of Energy federally does not set a standard, states are free to set standards. Once the federal department sets a standard, states are then preempted by that standard. However, states can seek a waiver of that preemption if they have a need to go beyond that. The furnaces standard in particular has gone years and years without being updated at the federal level. Massachusetts and Rhode Island actually went ahead and passed their standards, I believe, over about a year and a half ago now. The U.S. Department of Energy actually responded by saying, we invite states from relatively colder climates to go ahead and request waivers for preemption, because we understand that furnaces are going to make more sense in colder states, whereas half the country in the warmer half isn't going to want that. So there is a process that we could exceed that standard if we want to. However, as Ms. Merrill testified, that'll take a while. It'll take probably 5 to 6 years before we could implement a standard in Oregon. And so for all of those reasons, we're comfortable with removing the furnace standard, primarily because, as Ms. Merrill testified, the Building Codes Division is considering an upgrade to building codes that would include a high-efficiency furnace as one option for meeting an increased building codes requirement. And so we think that gets you the majority of the benefit on a faster timeline, and is at least a good starting point for that standard, and we could come back and reconsider that later if it's not getting the energy savings we'd like. The second issue that's come up is this issue around the consumer electronics, where the manufacturers, as you've heard, object to setting a standard for these electronics. Let me first point out on this chart from American Council on Energy Efficient Economy, if you look at the annual energy savings between the two electronics products, it's about 5 gigawatt hours of electricity per year. That's about a fifth of the energy savings in the bill. So roughly translated, that means that we'd be getting around, I'm just doing math in my head here, a little more than, out of that 18,000 households worth of electricity saved by 2020, a little more than 3,000 households worth of electricity saved just from these electronic standards. These electronic standards are also very narrow. The electronic standards, are the they only apply to the amount of electricity consumed by the product when it's in standby mode, meaning when the consumer actually thinks it's turned off. This limits how much electricity it continues to consume. And then the final thing I'll draw your attention to is in the second column from the left, the compact audio and DVD players, the incremental cost there, meaning increased cost of a product, is $1. This is not an expensive proposition for consumers. Let me then talk a little bit about Energy Star. The Energy Star is an important program.
May I interrupt again? Okay. Jeremiah, let's go back to this chart here. This one, oops. So the first column, if I understand this, annual savings per unit. This is kilowatts or therms. So, for example, on the compact audio products, you're saying per unit, we're going to save each year 53 kilowatts.
Kilowatt hours.
Thank you. Kilowatt hours. And the incremental cost per unit is only $1. And then you're saying that the annual energy savings from 1 year's sales of compact audio products is going to be 4.4 gigawatt hours. Am I reading that correctly?
No, I'm sure. I'm really, yes.
If you go down that column to the total line, the 23.9, that's the anticipated annual energy savings from 1 year's sales of all of these things. And that's where you're saying that it's roughly one-fifth of that is compact audio products. Is that correct?
Correct.
So the other thing I'm not quite clear on in this chart, you'll notice the row residential furnaces and boilers, the 380,110.6, and then there's an unlabeled row below that in italics, 52,373, etc. What does that second row represent?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, that represents the natural gas savings. I'm not a graphic designer, and I don't do a very good job making these things as clear as I ought to. So the first row, labeled residential furnaces and boilers, is the electricity savings that you'd get. In the second row, that's in italics, is the natural gas savings. So similarly, in the total, you'll see there's a second number below that 23.9. The 23.9 is the electricity. 217.3 is gas savings.
Got it.
Okay. These appliances are both gas powered and electricity powered.
Aren't some of them also propane?
That would be the furnaces as well.
Is that included in the natural gas row?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I am not sure if it is included or not. The propane sales are so small by volume, I'm not sure if they're simply not included or if they are included. Either way, it would not change the number substantially because there are relatively few.
So, all right, now that I thoroughly understand these first few columns, I guess I'm trying to figure out in my mind what we're doing here. We're trying to save energy, and yet one-fifth of what we're trying to do, and these compact audio products includes, well, it really doesn't include, but we'll throw the DVD players in, which makes it a nice round 5.0, or no?
Well, almost.
So all these little things that we see everybody packing around and the stuff that we play DVDs on and the Netflix comes in the mail and we watch it on the weekends, one-fifth of everything we're trying to do here is going to be based on those products versus all of these larger things, the furnaces and the hot tubs and the water coolers and all this kind of stuff?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
The question is, Jeremiah, I'm trying to, and I'm not the energy expert, but, you know, to me, a little device like this, it would just be intuitive to me, is going to consume in and of itself less energy than a bigger device, like a hot tub.
So either we're selling a gazillion more of these small devices, or there's something I'm missing here.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, it's certainly in part because we sell large numbers of small products. So they each unit uses, if you look at the incremental unit savings, you know, the commercial hot food holding cabinets are saving 1,800 kilowatt hours of electricity each unit does, compared to 11 kilowatt hours for a DVD player. But then if you look over in that third column, the DVD players statewide, looking at all the sales statewide, are actually saving slightly more energy due to this standard than the hot food holding cabinet standard would save. That's simply because hot food holding cabinets are really only bought by, you know, 7-Elevens and restaurants and that sort of thing, so there's not that many of them sold every year.
Well, I think it'd be helpful in this chart to include the estimated number of units sold in Oregon, because it just would help kind of put things in context, if you will.
And what would also be helpful is the Energy Star rating, which I think you we're about to discuss, because there's, when we brought this bill, House Bill 3363 last time, there was a lot of confusion about why we needed standards when we have Energy Star. And if you've gone out and purchased, I bought a refrigerator last year, and we learned very quickly that the Energy Star rated refrigerators were not always the most energy efficient refrigerators. We actually bought one that was rated higher than Energy Star. So I think you were about to allude to that, and I think that would be helpful as well.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, shall I continue?
Yeah, go ahead, and then we'll take Representative Smith's question.
Energy Star is an excellent program. Osberg fully supports it. Some of our sister organizations in other states have actually, you know, helped promote that and promote the purchase of Energy Star products by consumers. And Energy Star, however, I would argue, works in tandem with setting standards. It's really, think about energy policy, you do certain things to drive the market and build the market, and then when the market can bear it, you set a standard to make sure that you kind of get rid of the last of the, you know, sort of energy hogs essentially that are still out there. So we've done this in Oregon, where the residential energy tax credit or the energy trust incentive programs offer financial assistance to people to purchase more energy efficient products, but they only apply to products that are a certain margin better than the average thing on the market, and those actually increase over time as the market gets better, and as standards, either at the state or federal level, mean that, in fact, the lowest efficiency products can no longer be sold at all. The Energy Star product kind of works similarly. It's not a financial incentive. It's simply a labeling program that is a signal to consumers that is pretty well recognized by now. But it just doesn't cover a significant portion of the market. So what this would say is the Energy Star applies to the highest efficiency products, and the standard would make sure that all products are at least meeting a basic level of energy efficiency. And so that is kind of the way those two pieces work together. The Energy Star standards, as the chair has pointed out very widely, for some products they're not actually currently very high relative to the market because they have to take time to update those standards. But I think the Energy Star program, really what it's done is create a market for more energy efficient electronics products. It means a lot of the products out there do already meet that standard, and it means that it's easier to put a standard in place because there aren't going to be any less efficient products that are going to get cut off by it, partially because that market has been built. I'd also just like to point out, in light of the testimony from the Consumer Electronics Association, this argument about stifling innovation. I guess I sort of have two thoughts on that. One thing is, it seems like a pretty basic consumer expectation to require that products use as little energy as possible when they're in standby mode. And I don't think it's a major stifling of innovation to say that further features added shouldn't require significant increases in energy consumption. And on this convergence issue, where, you know, you have a DVD player and a TV player, and then you have two, that's partially why the bill includes definitions for the products, so that we're limiting what is included in each product, and it's not like anything that ever plays a DVD will always be covered by the standard. It's the products that are defined specifically by the bill as having to meet the standard. But my bottom line on the consumer electronics issue is, I really think that the standard is not a burdensome standard. Again, $1 in increased cost to get thousands of households worth of electricity saved seems like a very common sense policy. And I'll just stop there.
Representative Smith had a question, then we'll move on to the other part of the witness stand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good seeing you, Jeremiah. To me, it's logical that when you reduce energy consumption, the expense that consumers or small business owners have to pay decreases.
do you know of any cost-benefit studies that are out there that show the benefit to the consumer from reducing their energy consumption versus the investment they're making in the modification? If there is, it'd be great if this committee could take a look at that.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, this chart actually includes some of that information, although, as we've already discovered, this chart isn't so easy to withdraw useful information from.
I need pie charts.
I agree. We'll work on that tonight. If you look on the far right column, I think is the most helpful one. That is the net present value, total millions of dollars saved for each product. It's the amount of money spent on energy bills saved.
That's money in the consumer's pocket.
Correct. And it also, and that is after accounting for the increased price of the product. So it's net savings, not total savings, which I think is elsewhere on the chart.
And just to follow up on that, Jeremiah, does that include then deferred costs, for instance, of adding energy, you know, for your energy bill where it's deferred from adding additional load? In other words, you know, if there's enough savings, then that defers the increase in load, you know, for further out.
Madam Chair, I don't believe that is included. If I understand correctly, the energy conservation has even bigger indirect savings because you reduce the need to build a new generation facility ultimately, and therefore you avoid an increase in rates to pay for the new generation. I don't believe that is accounted for in the cost savings calculations, but if you look at the column right under the number 2030 that is labeled summer peak capacity reduction, that is the reduction in the total amount of electricity at the, you know, highest energy consumption day of the summer for the state of Oregon that results from these standards. And that's actually a significant number. If you look, you know, the total there is 35.2 megawatts. That's the size of a, you know, small end of medium-sized wind farm or a larger-than-average biomass plant. So it's a significant amount of energy that we don't need to build just to meet that, you know, biggest day of the summer when air conditions are running level of energy consumption.
All right, great. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Craven.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association. Like the Consumer Electronics Association, we are also a national high-tech trade association. We do have probably many members in common between the two trade associations. So I want to a couple comments here today. One, just to ask for your consideration of the points that the CEA has brought to you today. They're the experts on this more than I am, but I think they do make some points. I think, you know, the point about whether we mandate standards in law or we rely upon private sector activities like Energy Star, I think is a valid one, and I would hold it out for your consideration. I was going to ask you to try to find out what the value of these products was in the overall picture, but Jeremiah, like always, had the chart here to help elucidate that for all of us. Pie charts in color would be preferable next time. Two other issues, though, specific issues. One, I want to thank the chair in this committee for its earlier work on House Bill 2565, which was sort of known as the cleanup or the catch-up for what we did last session on some of the issues about the lights and the external power supplies and such. That bill came out of Senator Vakian's committee Thursday, Friday, and is headed to the Senate floor. I think it passed the House unanimously. So something I bring to your attention and to your staff's attention particularly is there is a conflict between the two bills. I was assured this morning that there wasn't, but upon further looking, they amend some of the same ORSs. Some of it is additive, but on the really key issue about what the director of the Department of Energy can or cannot do in adjusting standards, and certainly we had that debate last session and then during the interim, the two bills are different. We would prefer the bill that you've already passed, 2565, the language in there. We think it gives the director of the Department of Energy, I think, the ability to fix the situation we found ourselves in last interim. Essentially, if we were to go down this road and try to ape California standards and California 9 months from now, backed off, modified, walked away from the consumer electronics standards, I believe the bill you've already passed would allow the Director of Department of Energy to accommodate that situation. So I'm not sure if council has given you a conflict amendment yet or
we're working on it.
But in that case, I guess I would make a pitch for the bill. You've already passed unanimously in this body and is going to the Senate floor. So it's be Section 7 of House Bill 2565 rather than Section 7 of the current bill. So just wanted to make a pitch for that. Whatever you decide to do with the underlying bill in 375, we would hope that we can do that conflict in concert with the House passed bill.
Thank you for raising that issue, and we have been alerted to that, and we're working on an amendment right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries and its Retail Council. We represent, as part of our membership, some of the nation's largest retailers. We have some of the shared concerns that Mr. Johnson and Mr. Craven have indicated. We have concerns about the compact audio products and the DVD players. One of the other concerns that we haven't mentioned, and we have been in discussions with the Department of Energy and Osberg, it's the timeline. And we had a good example last session of when you try to implement something and then something goes awry in California, it leaves the legislature a situation that they have to fix. So we do like the 2565 language. But there are other reasons to have a fair timeline. Even if you are trying to comply with California's timeline and trying to work with them and what other products might be covered, we still have to send the right signals through the what I would call the consumer food chain. And retailers are really just about at the end of that food chain. And we have, even though some of us own our own distribution networks and such, we do need to send the message up. And what we saw last session is the retailer was actually the last one to get word that there was a problem with implementation in the law. And what generally we hear about is, it's not so much as a year, it's about 18 months is the best timing for that signal to crawl up or crawl down the food chain. In Section 7, you'll also see that the Department of Energy can add new regulations. My read, and I just checked with the Department of Energy, they can add new product without legislative authority. Well, you give them the authority to do that, pardon me. And, again, that timeline is 1 year, and that could be, again, a problem for retailers as we try to get the messages from higher up in the food chain and send our signals through the market. Again, and as you have heard today, you know, we are big proponents of the Energy Star. And as an example, I had a retailer call me at the beginning of the session and said, Julie, do you think you can pass a bill to get an Energy Star sales tax holiday passed in Oregon? I said I was very sure I could accomplish that this session.
Yeah.
So
in Oregon.
Yeah, in Oregon, and I feel pretty pleased about that. So anyway, that's our testimony, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much, and appreciate your input.
Madam Chair, I would like to note for the record that another state PERG asked Osberg if we would offer the same bill in Oregon for a sales tax holiday.
This is how Jeremiah and I work so well together. We've got it accomplished.
You're working on a lot of bills in concert. You're making us nervous this session, you guys. Okay, next, and we have a few more minutes left, so I'm going to try to get everybody up here. I think the next folks up are in regards to the gas furnace issue. We have Gary Bauer, George Cook, Jim Anderson, and Lana Butterfield. So why don't you all come up? And then we have two after that, so we'll try to get you all up here. And I know that you're all talking about that same issue, so we'll just see if you can try to maybe triage here on your testimony. Jim, why don't you get started? We'll work down the line here and pull up another chair.
Madam Chair, Jim Anderson of Vista Corporation. For brevity's sake, I will keep my statement short. We are a natural gas serving utility of the state of Oregon. We serve basically southern Oregon, Douglas, Jackson, Josephine counties, and Klamath County, and we also serve eastern Oregon and Umatilla, parts of Umatilla, and Union County. I would like to have Mr. Cook make our main comments here, but I'm encouraged by some of the comments that were made earlier in the fact that residential furnaces are to be amended out of the bill. I think that the committee will find, as they explore that issue, that is actually a benefit to the bill. It'll kick to building codes. issue will still be accomplished over time, that the energy savings will be found within the building codes exercise. So with that, Madam Chair, I will end my comments there. Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is George Cook, and I represent the Gas Appliance Manufacturers Association, GAMA for short. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before the Energy Environment Committee concerning Senate Bill 375, legislation that would set efficiency standards for certain products and appliances. Now, I have to say I came here to rant and rave and wax poetic about why these products should be taken out of the bill, but a couple of the people who have spoken before me did a wonderful job, including your Department of Energy and Senator Walker herself, so I feel almost a little unimportant here, but I guess my company sent me here to speak, so I better do it, or it seems like I took a holiday to Oregon. Just to address a couple of specific points and things that were brought up earlier. Residential furnaces, that would be the main issue of this bill for us. There's a cost increase that's associated with the 90% standard versus the standard that is in effect now, and actually the 80% standard that will become the federal minimum in September of this year because of the Federal Department of Energy rulemaking that will be in effect. The product price itself will increase from $300 to $500, but the thing that makes furnaces different from a lot of the other products in this legislation is the fact that the major bulk of the increase in price is not from the product itself, it's from the installation of the product. A 90% furnace is almost a basically, it's a different kind of technology from an 80% furnace. An 80% furnace, you put it in the, plop it in the middle of your basement, it vents right up to your chimney. That's how you get rid of all the bad gases and stuff. But a 90% furnace is what is called a condensing furnace. And it's called a condensing furnace because it actually condenses the water vapor that's in the waste gases. And you have to get rid of that differently than venting it through your chimney. So you actually have to drill holes in the sides of your basement to vent the product out. You have to collect that water that's collected and get rid of it. So the product price, including installation, can be as much as $2,000 more for a 90% furnace than for an 80% furnace. This is a rather large increase, and that causes a pretty significant issue. Also, there is the waiver of federal preemption situation, and that is if the state of Oregon would set its own 90% standard, you would have to file a waiver of federal preemption with the Department of Energy, Federal Department of Energy. The Department of Energy, earlier in October of last year, did, in its notice of public record for the rulemaking for furnaces and boilers, stated that there are 20 states in the United States of America that could actually make a good argument for possibly asking for a waiver of federal preemption. They set the basic minimum criteria for that at being 6,000 population-weighted heating degree days over the last 30 years. I just want, for the record, to state that all of those 20 states are east of here. Oregon was not one of those states. Washington was not one of those states. California was not one of those states. Oregon has 5,454 heating degree days, population-based, for that specific period of time. So even if Oregon was to pass a 90% standard, if they filed for a waiver of federal preemption, you don't meet the minimum criteria that the Department of Energy already has set in order for states to apply for that. So that's why we believe that the different route that we're taking is the better process. Building codes can be molded to take into account the advantages and limitations of high-efficiency furnaces. A code that meets the objective of energy efficiency while preserving reasonable homeowner options in the choice of a furnace is permitted under federal law and can be implemented as soon as the code is adopted. We are working with interested parties in Oregon, including proponents of Senate Bill 375, on an amendment to address this issue via the building code. We urge your support for that approach and our amendment, and we would like to also thank the DOE and other groups that are working with us on this amendment. I can take any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. You've already heard a lot about it. Just a brief comment is that we share the goal of finding energy efficiency. We actually we do very little television advertising, primarily on safety, and the other advertising is on trying to promote 90% or better furnaces. And we do that by promoting the program through the Energy Trust. We work with manufacturers for rebates, and we promote the tax credits. However, we do find, as has been mentioned, that it's not cost-effective for all customers. And there's some comments in my testimony about smaller homes, low-income folks, et cetera. The only other comment I might make is that the other
concern we have is that this actually may drive people to use either stay with an old inefficient heating system based on the cost, or to do some other measures which may actually go against your goals of trying to reduce greenhouse gases and other issues. So we support the building codes concept of developing a menu approach and working with that, and we will be involved in that process. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm here with the Northwest Propane Gas Association. And as you heard, I'm the little cousin to these, my much bigger cousins. And we have the same interest that they do. Our concern is for our customers who have to replace a furnace and face these really big installation costs. I wanted to take a minute to say thank you to Senator Walker and to Jeremiah Bauman for working with this group and seeing if they couldn't come to some agreements. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, and we'll look forward to receiving the amendment. Are there any quick questions?
Yeah, quick question, Madam Chair. This all sounds perfectly reasonable. I guess I wonder over the long term, if we don't include furnaces in here, how we retrofit these homes where currently installation of a 90% furnace is quite costly. What can your companies do? What can we as a policy-making body do to help encourage that eventual transition to 90%?
Well, I think what the amendment that we are introducing attempts to do is, through new construction practices, give home builders the option to put 90% furnaces in new homes. Bottom line is, all homes that have been built in America since the Pilgrims are based on the fact of vertical venting. You know, you have chimney vent through the chimney from a furnace or whatever else. So we've also just jumped on that. That's what 80% furnace does. It incorporates that. There are going to be difficulties, with a 90% furnace in an older home. Just for instance, if you finished your basement and you spent thousands of dollars on that, we come in and, a contractor comes in and drills holes in your finished basement. That's $10,000 down the drain. If you've built a deck and you have to sidewall vent now, and that venting is an inch above the deck, well, you got to do something there. You got to remove that portion of the deck because what if it snows and you cover the vent? I mean, that's just the way your house has been built, and it wasn't made to incorporate a 90% furnace. It isn't cost ineffective for everybody. So I want to make that point clear. We support energy efficient products. Our companies make energy efficient products, and they're good for a large portion of the consumers. But for about 20 to 24% of the consumers in northern states specifically, you'll lose money if forced to purchase a 90%. Those are DOE numbers that was placed in the October NOPR as well. So, there's just going to be a chunk of people that if they have to get 90% furnace, they're going to lose money on the deal. That's just all there is to it.
All right. Thank you. Thanks. Appreciate you coming here, and hope you enjoy your holiday in Oregon. Spend lots of money while you're here.
I'll do my best.
Last but not least, we have Jeff Bissonnette and John Chandler.
We're having a sales tax holiday.
Yeah. Yeah. Every day is a sales tax holiday in Oregon, unfortunately. John, we'll let you go.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. In light of the previous testimony, I'll be very brief. If this bill continues to contain residential furnaces, we are quite concerned. If it does not, we will go back to sleep, along with the electronic appliances.
Put you on standby.
Although I would like to call the committee's attention to the equation on line 31, page 8, where, from a liberal arts major standpoint, violates several rules. It combines letters, numbers, parentheses, and a fraction hanging in the air. I just want to object to that on aesthetic grounds. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You skipped out on that part of math. We know.
I switched major every time that came up. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition. Just a couple of brief comments. One, the coalition does support the amendments for the furnaces that have been discussed here at length. Two, some of the comments about the director's authority between this bill and House Bill 2565 really is a policy call for this committee and for the legislature. you know, it's sort of giving the increased authority to the director of the Department of Energy to make these adjustments as they go along, or we'll have an appliance bill every session if you don't get given that authority. So it's basically how you want to spend the state's policy making time. That said, as was just noted, I was just thinking that having these bills is actually an economic development driver for the state, having folks come out from Arlington, Virginia, from GAMMA and CEA to testify on the bill. And so I know for Mr. Johnson, I think this is the second or third time we've seen him. I heard from national folks that track these things that this very same issue is being heard today in the New Jersey legislature. So we ran one out over in New Jersey. I did want to bring up a quick thing on the Energy Star point, and that is we at the Coalition, and particularly the Citizens Utility Board, have been very supportive of Energy Star and have actually had grant money for special projects in the past to promote Energy Star through the Consumer Federation of America. And so we do think it is a helpful approach. But this is a little dangerous to kind of interpret a chart that's not yours that you haven't looked at for all that long. But I think on page 3 of Mr. Johnson's testimony is sort of the reason why we want standards as opposed to just relying on Energy Star, as good as Energy Star is. If you look on page 3, and I'll point you to two lines. One is the triangle line, which represents DVDs, and one are the X line, which does compact audio. You do see, for the most part, sort of an upward trend, except for 2003, when apparently we had more stringent levels come into play for Energy Star. And so we went from 60 to 75% market share for Energy Star products, and sort of plummeted, as I read this, down to about a 10% market share for Energy Star products for compact audio products, and about a 45% or so share on DVDs, which leaves a whole level of the market uncovered by Energy Star. And so that is, again, precisely why we want to set the standards, because as good as Energy Star is, it takes a while for the market to catch up. And so if we can accelerate that product by setting the standards and capture the energy efficiency sooner rather than later. Those are all my comments. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Jeff, I'm not quite sure I understood what you were pointing out regarding this chart.
So I was looking at two lines, the triangle line for DVD that were labeled DVDs, and the line which sort of marked X's for the compact audio products. And if you kind of follow that, those lines all the way to what's marked as 2004, the X is about at a 10% market share level, and the triangle DVD marking is at about a 45%. And so that's the share of the market that is represented by Energy Star qualifying products.
Well, Madam Chair, I understand. Jeff, actually, when I first looked at this chart, I had the same question, but I think what that's showing is that in 2003, as it says, more stringent levels began. As the improvements were being made, it resets. That's part of the Energy Star program. So, yeah, the number drops down, but the standards are actually higher.
Right. And so, but even if you take that, you know, the best we got was a quarter of the market to, a third of the market was still uncovered by standards, and that's still a fair amount of inefficient or less efficient, shall we say, products out there. And so, again, if we set the standard, and especially because we do have a state that is a market driver in the form of California, directly to our south, and we have a lot of communities like, you know, Medford, Ashland, Klamath Falls, where if we have a lesser standard, we can see less efficient appliances sort of being offered for sale here in the state if we don't keep our appliance standards in line.
Thank you. Any other quick questions before we adjourn? With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 375 and close the House Energy and Environment Committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.